This is The Deep Dive with Brooke Spector. Investigative conversations about issues that impact our lives. Be curious. Friday mornings at 9 a.m. only on 101.9 High FM.
And this is The Deep Dive, and I'm Brooke Spector. And as we do every time at this time, we talk with somebody who knows a lot more about something than I do, and hopefully can entertain and inform both me and you, the listeners, on a topic of interest and importance to us. And today I'm really pleased to bring back a colleague from the Daily Maverick, Marion Merton, who is the parliamentary watcher, years of experience doing that. It's an interesting question for me, because when we think about democratic political systems, it's a really easy and almost insidious tendency to focus almost entirely on the executive, president, chancellor, prime minister, their cabinet, because, you know, that's a discrete set of people or one person, and you can see what they're doing. And then when it gets to an election, it becomes what Americans call horse race politics. Who's ahead? Who's behind? What do the polls say? Who's debating whom? But in a democracy, in a democratic system, the parliament or the Congress or the legislature, whatever you want to call it in each country, they matter enormously too. And for many of us, it's something of a black box. We know stuff goes in and we know stuff comes out, but it's not entirely clear what happens inside the box. It's not quite like Schrodinger's cat, but it's close, because we know they're alive. We know they're in that box. But most of us aren't really clear on what this all means. And yet it is crucial to our understanding of our respective political systems to understand more about that. And that's why someone who, like Marion, who watches it carefully and pays attention and helps us understand it, becomes that much more crucial in a democratic society. The problem is further exacerbated because a lot of parliamentary conversations and debates, it all sounds like it's a secret language spoken in a code mere mortals don't understand. It's as if they were using an ancient Middle Eastern tongue that's no longer in use, and they're talking about something that nobody has any idea about except the people involved in it, because they then speak in acronyms and shorthand, and we have to figure it out. And so that's why somebody who can do that for us becomes really important. And so therefore, Marion, welcome. And I'm glad you're here to help do this.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Now, we were talking just before we started our recording for this. You were telling us that, you, in fact, right now, you're not even in South Africa. You're watching this whole thing from a distance in a European nation. And that leads me to the obvious question. How do you keep track? And how do you understand? How do you see inside that black box?
It's a lot of work. And I think some of the things that need to be done take a little bit more time. It's not a case of simply bumping into somebody on the parliamentary precinct and having a discussion or popping to an MP's office to have a chat. Look, so there's a whole network, and one of the things is that, you know, you keep on having the conversations with people. It is so important just to continue talking to various people, to just get informed, to stay on top of things. And look, one of the reasons I'm able to do this for now, it's actually quite a sad thing, in the sense that, you know, with the COVID lockdown and then obviously that devastating fire in January 2022, Parliament continued to be online in order to get its processes and its business to continue. So being online, being on Zoom calls, in committee meetings, being on YouTube, that allows remote working, which is what I'm doing. None of it is replacing the personal contact. So that is absolutely important. So I spend a lot of time on the phone talking to people in South Africa still.
We were talking too. I said, if I have a friend in Washington who does something similar. I mean, he was for many years a congressional staff assistant and then a staff assistant for an individual congressman. And then he became, in that dreaded word, a lobbyist. But he was the person I always went to find out what was the status of any bill or hearing. And he would show me the whole system of tracking these measures as they moved through the Congress or didn't move, and how you could interpret what any of it meant. And there was this enormous complex matrix of things because all the moving parts. Does the Parliament South Africa have something similar, or is it moving in that direction?
I think a lot of what you've just outlined is already in place. It's maybe a case of people who are interested knowing that, you know what, log on to Parliament website. You've got various sections. So if you're looking for a bill, you will see exactly where what bill is. PMG, Parliamentary Monitoring Group, has got some amazing, helpful, interesting transcripts and summaries of committee meetings. Those are immediately online, easily accessible resources that literally anybody who wants to catch up and just maybe find out things can access. Some of the more complex, and I really do like the description about arcane language and all of that in the parliamentary processes, because you're quite right. But let me get back to that. So some of the processes are perhaps a little bit more complex to follow. Particularly, for example, I mean, let's take the NHI bill, the National Health Insurance Bill.
I was going to ask you about that immediately, because that's the one that presumably touches everybody.
Exactly. And it's quite interesting because on the 14th of June, so that's next week, it will be in the National Assembly for discussion, debate, adoption. We're expecting, given the context, given the bill, it's expected to be quite an interesting and heated debate. But that bill actually kicked off over 3 years ago in the parliamentary process. And if you wanted to speak even longer term in terms of policies, that has been in the making since 2010 at least. So it's part and parcel of the job, like your lobbyist friend in the US, and something that I do, something that other journalists who are based in Parliament and who do policy, governance, legislation focused things rather than executive and party political focus in their work. You kind of develop the contacts, the networks, you manage to track and trace, so to speak, and it becomes second nature in many ways.
So there is a shorthand. You have to know the code. It's sort of like you need one of the ultra machines to figure out what in the world's going on. But with this National Health Insurance Plan, which you quite rightly point to as being well over a decade in debate, I just add, as a parenthesis, Medicare in the United States, the old medical care, government paid medical care for people over 65, was an item of discussion in the political system really since about the 1930s, and it only got passed in the mid 1960s. So these things have a very long gestation period, much longer than an elephant or a whale. But what is your sense of where the NHI bill is going? I mean, I know there's a lot of criticism from interested parties and not a whole lot, as far as I can tell, of the kind of scoring, what it will actually cost and who will benefit and who will not, what will be the effect on the current population of physicians and other healthcare workers. That's what I don't find easily. But it's obviously something that's crucial to 60 million people.
You hit the nail on the head, really. This bill sets up the funding and the broad legislative framework. So perhaps some of the details may emerge closer in regulations. Yes, the bill is, it's a very political piece of legislation in the sense of some of the public discourse. And you're quite right to say that there's a lot of criticism, even by people and organizations who have come out in support of the principle of universal healthcare, of a national health insurance. So there's this disjunct. I don't think you will find anybody in South Africa who will oppose universal healthcare. I think in a country with our health and illness profiles, everybody will support it. The healthier we are, the better it will be for us as a country. The bits and pieces come in on how the bill has been structured. So, for example, one of the sticking points, for want of a better example, is that once the bill becomes law, and there's still a process to go and we can get back to that, medical aid, private medical aids cannot offer services that the NHI offers. So private medical aid would basically be for your Botox job or your nose job or, you know, elective surgeries like that. But now that would suddenly mean that our public hospitals and our health system would literally be inundated with everybody, because the bill also talks about a referral pathway. So you have to start with the GP in your area. If, for example, you as Brooks have a GP who lives across town and that's been your family GP for the last 20 years or 10 years, under the new system, there's a good chance you may not be able to go see that GP anymore. And you must start around the corner from where you live. So those are some of the things that have really rubbed up in many ways, even organizations and healthcare providers who are supportive of a national healthcare. Some of the issues around what do private hospitals do? The NHI bill does suggest that government will be the sole purchaser of whole health products. So there is a provision that maybe private health hospitals, for example, will then be contracted in to the system to provide services for the NHI. It's been broadly discussed. There's been many public hearings around it. I think when the final version of this bill, which we will see on the 14th of June in the House, was adopted by the committee, I think there were some expressions of regret by those who had made public submissions that the bill actually hadn't changed very much.
I'm going to ask you to hold that thought, and we're going to take a brief station break. This is The Deep Dive, and I'm Brooke Spector, and we're going to take a break for just a minute, and we'll be right back. Pick and Pay Norwood Hyper have these wonderful pocket-saving deals just for you. Clover Gouda, white cheddar, cheddar or Tassels cheese, 800 grams. Buy any two for 198 rand.
This is The Deep Dive with Brooke Spector.
This is The Deep Dive. I'm Brooke Spector, and we're speaking with Marion Merton, the Daily Maverick's parliamentary watcher and, dare I say, parliamentary interpreter to the rest of us. And she was, before we took this break, she was busy explaining that the bill for the National Health Insurance hits the main floor of the parliament, wherever that might end up being met these days. Much of what took place in committee will have been drawn into the bill, and then the box will be opened up all over again for argument and debate. And you were explaining about the intricacies of drawing heretofore private hospitals into this system in some way, shape, or form that is not yet clear to most of us.
I think it's clear in terms of the legislative drafting language what must happen. I think a lot of the concerns, and I think that has been something that's been running through, is in the implementation. So this NHI bill sets the legal framework. The simplest way of putting it is that basically government will be the provider of all healthcare, and everything falls and flows from there. Concerns about the minister's power in terms of setting up the supervisory structures, concerns quite rightfully, I would think, in the light of state capture years, that a health funding, which will be billions and billions and billions of rand in order to provide through the NHI, could be misappropriated.
I can't imagine such a thing.
Yeah. So the legislation is incredibly political, and it is incredibly talking to some of the concerns of the broader South African society. And I think that is one of the complicating things. In terms of the lawmaking, I mean, all the boxes were ticked: public hearings, discussions, deliberations, legal input, all of that. And I think that is also now the point which is important, because this is maybe the springboard, possibly, we don't know at this stage, of future legal challenges that have been spoken about, quite honestly. the disappointment that public participation suggestions, be that from medical association, doctors association, healthcare providers, private hospital association. I mean, the submissions were humongous and drawn out. The criticism that not much had actually been changed in the legislation, even after all of this public participation and submissions. That's something I think we need to park. We might have to get back there should a legal challenge on this arise. What will happen in the House next week is going to be a bruising expected debate, politics, because this bill is steeped in politics. Ahead of the 2024 elections, I mean, all the political parties are going to try and make their most of it. And that is some of the obfuscation that happens in our body politic around lawmaking. Parliament does not exist outside of a political, outside of a social context. And in South Africa, that can be very robust and very loud. The stuff about the processes and the language and all of this, you know, sometimes I do firmly believe that as journalists, as reporters on these matters, we have a responsibility to try and break down the arcane language and try and explain to readers. At least I try. Sometimes it's difficult. I would expect, for example, next week, because for the governing ANC, it's very important that this bill goes through. It's a policy cornerstone. It has been since the NGC in Durban in 2010. This NHI politically, and everything gets exaggerated, exacerbated, don't know what the right word is at this stage, in the run-up to an election. So this is a policy cornerstone for the governing ANC, but also for its partners, the SACP, the trade unions, COSATU, who really want this. Next week, three-line whip, everybody will be in the House. So the ANC has to make sure that this passes. When I say three-line whip, it's basically an instruction from the chief whip that says everybody must be in the House unless they are really ill or they have another good excuse and they can provide a doctor's letter or something. When I say must be in the House, the way Parliament works at the moment is that with the COVID restrictions having been lifted, despite the fire damage that has literally gutted the National Assembly chamber and offices around that part, but there has been a move to meet physically in a small venue called the Good Hope Chamber, and then have a hybrid session. So there will be MPs in the House actually physically sitting, and then a lot of the other MPs will dial in via online platform. And that is how Parliament has operated and continues to operate for now, given some of the restrictions, as the fire really had a big impact.
Let me change the different issue. Yes. So we're stay with Parliament, obviously, but because I think we will all pay close attention to exactly how you interpret what has happened next week. I know I will be reading it carefully, as well as other sources if I can. But there's another bill which has, or another proposal really, which has generated lots of storm and drang around the country. And that's the a bill that deals with water for commercial farms. As far as I can tell, the bill will in some way make use of racial quotas to distribute water for commercial farming, although I don't understand the mechanism, nor do I really know where it stands. And I hope you can explain it all for us in a couple of minutes.
Cool. Let me start off with this. And this is maybe some of the confusion that may arise. It's not actually a bill. It is regulations. And regulations are secondary legislation, but it's something that the executive does. It all arises from the National Water Act. Yeah, it's a slightly different process at the Water and Sanitation Department level. Look, these are draft regulations. So at the moment, nothing is settled, nothing is finalized at this point. I can understand the storm that has erupted, because essentially what these draft regulations are saying is that for businesses that are using X amount of water, you need to have X amount of Black economic empowerment. And I think if it's 250,000 liters, you need to have 25% of Black shareholding in your business. And then it goes up to almost 75% Black shareholding if you use more than a million waters. It's an interesting one because there is a background to that. And this is where some of the parliamentary watching kind of brief focuses comes in. It goes back literally to about 1998. Given our apartheid inequality and poverty, water rights are incredibly important in rural areas. And water rights have tended to be generally allocated to white farmers, white communities. So what this draft regulation, according to the department, wants to do is wants to equalize and transform some of those unequal relations. In the memorandum to the water regulations, the department points out that literally out of the 412 million, I think it is, liters of water rights, million cubic meters. That's the right measurement. Sorry. Literally only a quarter is held by what they call historically disadvantaged individuals, basically Black South Africans.
Yeah, this is not entirely different from the nature of arguments in other places. In the American West, water rights are something historically have even been settled with gunfire on occasion.
Let's hope we're not going down the gunfire route and that we can sort this out through regulation processes, public participation. But yeah, you could argue that this is an incredibly blunt instrument. I mean, if you are, say, for example, and this is a hypothetical example, if you are a chicken farmer somewhere in the Northwest or the Free State, and it's a family concern, you use half a million of cubic meters of water every year, and now these regulations, if they don't change, suddenly then means you suddenly have to turn your family business with a 50% Black shareholding. How do you do this? I mean, where do you do this? And if you don't do this, will you lose your water rights? If you lose your water rights, your business goes. I mean, it really touches on fundamental issues, and perhaps not everything was explained. The process wasn't explained as well as it could have. And so it has gotten this pushback. I would like to think that there is a public participation process. Get involved, make the submissions, put a case in, and try with this public participation, change, amend, nuance the proposed water licenses.
We're speaking with Marion Merton, the one who interprets Parliament for the rest of us for the Daily Maverick, and we'll be right back on The Deep Dive.
This is The Deep Dive with Brooke Spector.
And this is The Deep Dive. I'm Brooke Spector, and we're back again, and we're speaking with Marion Merton, Daily Maverick's parliamentary analyst, reporter, correspondent, the person who makes it all clear to the rest of us. And we've talked about a couple of different measures, and I want to just ask you about several others. There are amendments that apparently are coming forward on the Electoral Act, which obviously are going to be consequential because there's an election next year. And I'll pair that with something that might seem unconnected, but I think you might be able to see the connection for us. And that's the Lady R inquiry, which, at least as far as we understand it now, we're not going to see. And we're not going to know, and we're not even going to see the conclusions. And I'm not entirely sure why we have an inquiry like that. It's not a parliamentary inquiry, but I think there should be. And I'll let you comment on both of those things, the Elections Act and the Lady R.
Wow. Yes. Look, I think let's chat elections first. I think that's a little bit more straightforward. remember earlier in the year, we finally had the electoral amendment bill passed and the president signed it into law. So it's now the Electoral Amendment Act. That was the two and a half year process that was needed to give effect to the Constitutional Court judgment of June 2020 so that independent candidates can contest provincial and national elections. That's the basis of this discussion. Now, again, very political. There was a big push to have constituencies. That was not agreed to. Let's see whether and what happens there. From now that we have an Electoral Amendment Act, it means that a number of other legislation must be amended consequentially. I think one of the easiest things is that, for example, the Political Party Funding Act needs to be amended because it now must also say that independent candidates must also disclose sources of funding. Fairly technical, but needed. Some of the Electoral Commission Act, which is the act that basically establishes the IEC, also need to be amended precisely to make accommodation for independent candidates. I think the interesting one, and this is going to be interesting come the elections to see exactly how many ballot papers and how the ballot papers look and where this goes, is the amendments to the Electoral Act. So, for example, the IEC came to Parliament the other day. They were briefing the Home Affairs Committee because IEC falls under Home Affairs in the kind of government governance organogram. So because independents are based in regions, provinces, essentially, to make it a little bit more straightforward, we could very well see a case of having two ballot papers for the National Assembly, for the national elections. One, the one that we tend to be, that we're used to always in all previous elections, plus then another one that will reflect choices for independent candidates. In order to do that, some of the legislation needs to be amended. It's interesting. It's a little bit more complex than technicalities, but look, the IEC kind of seems to be on top of it. And it is just really a case of, can these amendments be done speedily? Because, yeah, like you said, elections are around the corner. And in some ways, if you listen to some of the parliamentary debates and the sittings, it almost seems if elections are right now, the way that the politicians are talking in those debates.
I mean, I remember the first everybody involved election, all parties, all colors, all whatever. It wasn't until just, I think, 2 weeks before, maybe even less, before the actual election, that the last party to sign on to participating in that election was, their name was actually affixed to the ballot. And in some cases, with a little piece of, a little sticky label that was stuck right at the bottom. Yeah. So you can move along rather smartly if you have to, in order to fulfill the basic function of a democratic nation.
No, absolutely. And yes, I remember those days as well. I mean, the IFP literally joined minute to midnight. And yes, millions and millions and millions of ballot papers. Everybody, you know, physically, somebody had to put that little sticker label on those ballot papers. It was done. It worked. Possibly not 30 years, because next year will also be 30 years of South Africa's constitutional democracy. Mm. Hopefully not so much. But look, I mean, for what it's worth, and we are in a difficult and complex time, and much public trust has been eroded in our institutions. Trust in politicians remains, if you look at some of the public opinion surveys, very low. 25%, 28%, 30% for both the governing and the opposition parties. However, the IEC still enjoys significant public trust confidence that our elections are indeed properly run. So there's a whole, I would like to think there's a whole institutional memory, planning, capacity, all of that, that will make sure that whatever needs to be done will be implemented, even if the politicians and the legislative processes, amendment processes in parliament might take a while. But fairly technical amendments, they shouldn't take time. Unlike the Lady R.
Now there's the segue for you because public trust is the question.
I don't think it's going to go away, to be quite honest. Officially, in terms of the statement that the presidency put out, the three-person team that's investigating, having a look at it, must report back within about 2 months. You know, these things are always a bit flexible because, you know, if you run up against obstacles and you do need another week or so to finalize your report, nobody's going to be unreasonable to say no. We saw that with the Zondo Commission reports. For me, it is very disquieting that it is all behind closed doors. I think that is a moment in our constitutional history where things may shift, and they may not shift for the better, for not even the terms of references to be made public, never mind the findings. Basically, I think for me, like you said earlier, what's the point? Because the only point that arises out of this secrecy is that perhaps the president or the presidency can stand up at a public platform and say, our inquiry shows that there were no concerns to the American ambassador's claims and issues that he raised. There's nothing more that can be said. And I don't think that this is what South Africa wants to go. Particularly, the Constitution does specify accountability, transparency, and openness and responsiveness as core constitutional democracy values. Look, the matter is going before court. I think the opposition DA says it will challenge that. Let's see what happens. I know I've spoken to some people and yes, there is a concern that certain things, operational things, you don't really want in the public domain. And that's a principle that is accepted within intelligence, within military intelligence, within all sorts of other security platforms. And I don't think anybody is questioning that. It is the blunt instrument approach of everything behind closed doors that is not setting a good precedent, especially given, for example, if you go back 2019, March, the high-level panel into the State Security Agency, that report was released, slightly redacted in the sense of testimony, witnesses' names were not mentioned, but it was released. We've had the same openness approach, for example, with the Sandy Africa panel that looked at the reasons and the causes and the recommendations, July 2021, the public unrest that hit KZN and parts of Gauteng. Again, the terms of references were published. The report findings and recommendations were published. So why this now? There is an argument, I think, accepted everywhere across the world, that certain operational things, okay, keep it behind closed doors. But a lot of what happened, especially considering that if you were living in Simonstown and you had one of the houses a little bit up, from the sea level, I mean, people with binoculars and even without binoculars, you could see one of the reasons why we know about all the Lady R controversies, the offloading and the unloading and the chases of cargo delivery vans across Simonstown is precisely because it was seen. People saw, residents saw. So, yeah, I don't know whether that answers your question.
It does in part, and we're going to take another break, and we'll be right back. And this is The Deep Dive, and I'm Brooke Spector, and our guest, of course, is Marion Merton, Daily Maverick's parliamentary Svengali, who explains it all to us. Is your shopping list longer and your time shorter? Dis-Chem Delivered has you covered, from healthcare essentials to baby food, beauty, and toiletries. Whatever you need, Dis-Chem Delivered has you covered. Download the easy-to-use Dis-Chem app and shop for over 7,000 products at in-store prices that will be delivered to you within 60 minutes. Now you can relax while Dis-Chem delivers your essentials to you. It's that simple. Dis-Chem Delivered, from Dis-Chem to you. Dis-Chem Pharmacies, pharmacists who care.
This is The Deep Dive with Brooke Spector.
And we are back, and this is The Deep Dive. I'm Brooke Spector, and my guest today, I'm delighted to have, Marion Merton, parliamentary correspondent for the Daily Maverick, a person who helps us understand what is going on. Now, let me just continue slightly with the topic, with the issue we were talking about, the Lady R and public access to the information. I think there are two arguments that I don't feel have been satisfactorily addressed by government. One is the public's right to know, if for no other reason than they're funding it. It is their report, in essence. It is the report that people have asked for to answer a question of public policy. The second, of course, is the international aspect to it. The country's reputation is being tested by the willingness of the government to investigate itself and produce a report which is, if not totally comprehensive in all manners and shapes, sufficiently so that the main questions get answered. And keeping it behind, effectively behind an impenetrable paywall doesn't seem to be the right way to answer one or the other of those points.
You're absolutely spot on, and I really think that your summary of the first point with regard to this is a report that the public has the right to have access to, some of the funding issues, I think I could not say it any better than that, because you're absolutely right. For me, the concern is this, as far as I know, I might be corrected, but as far as I know, this really is the first inquiry that is behind closed doors, full stop. To an extraordinary extent where not even the terms of references are being made public. I cannot recall, and maybe somebody will correct me on this, but I cannot recall any inquiry in democratic South Africa having had that kind of approach ever. Not even sensitive issues like if you take your mind back to whether the head of the prosecuting services at the time, Bulelani Ngqulwa, was a spy, as some people in the ANC had alleged. Also, you know, so I find it extremely worrying and concerning, because at the end of the day, we will not know what exactly was investigated, what were the processes, and what were the findings. All that will happen is that, as I said, the president or the presidency can say, no, we can now say after this inquiry, everything's above board and the American ambassador was mistaken. We have determined that there are some lapses in procedures and we will put in place measures to ensure there is no repeat. You know, whatever it goes, it'll be literally a bland statement at that, which really doesn't address any of the concerns. And that is the crucial bit, addressing the concerns, because you're quite right. The Lady R is a sanctioned Russian vessel. That in itself has exposed South Africa to potentially some sanctions or another. The fact that we haven't had any concrete action on that, I think, talks to South Africa's geopolitical standing, certainly with relations to the US, and everyone wanting to not do anything rash that would undermine that relationship at this stage.
You were speaking just for a second there on a previous public protector inquiry, and that in the time, we've got about 6 minutes, 5 minutes left. Can you touch on a topic which I know you're just desperate to explain to us in 5 minutes? And that's the, what is it? The S194 inquiry into the work quality of a certain Busisiwe Kubani, which is proceeding through the parliament in some way, shape or form. Clarify this whole thing for me. You got 5 minutes. Go.
Wow. No pressure, right? The easiest and the best way to just really explain to this is that it's ongoing. There are 4 million rand left for Busisiwe Mkhwebane's legal defense. When that money runs out, there's nothing left. Parliament had to go fundraise. And it's basically been just 11 months now of kicking to touch, obfuscation, hauling the committee to court. And I think if it says anything, it does say that if there is not a spirit of accepting processes and if there is an approach of Stalingrad legal tactics, values of constitutional democracy can be worn down and eroded. And this is what we've seen with the Section 194 inquiry. People will say, no, it's the suspended public protector's right to do all legal processes that she needs to do. But really, spending 6 days on talking to written statement that had been submitted and that everybody in the inquiry had read is also part of this. And let's see where it goes. They're resuming on Friday. The parliamentary inquiry has set 28 July as the time that the report must be finalized. At this point in time, it's interesting because 28 of July is in the middle of the parliamentary recess. So even if the report is finalized by then, Parliament will actually not be able to consider it up until when it returns from recess at the end of August at the earliest. So yeah, there's really not a lot to say except it's been grinding on the inquiry public hearings for 11 months. We've had some amazing, brave, courageous testimony from a number of whistleblowers from inside the public protector's office, also from outside, people who were affected by some of the reports that this particular public protector has done, for example, Johan van Lochrenberg. But we also had testimony from Mr. Kikana, who was inside of the public protectors. So people have come forward and people have made their contributions. Stalling and ensnaring it in legal appeals and challenges and requests for recusal. It's a legal strategy. Jacob Zuma, the former president, has deployed that on in various court proceedings. So has Busisiwe Mkhwebane. Yeah, I don't think the Constitutional Court, when it made the ruling that full legal representation must be provided to a Chapter 9 head in an impeachment inquiry, I don't think the Constitutional Court quite foresaw what has unfolded in this particular inquiry with a legal team of a senior counsel, which Darlene Porfall is. He's a senior counsel advocate, plus two juniors, plus law firms, plus everything else. When the Constitutional Court said that full legal representation must be provided, not what the rules had initially foreseen, as in there could be a lawyer present to advise. I don't think they expected this outcome. Certainly the MPs and Parliament itself is looking at this. So we've had discussions in the programming committee to say, look, maybe next time, if there is another similar proceeding, we need to put a cap. We need to tighten up the terms of references, and we need to put a cap on legal fees.
I really hate to break this off because I'm having so much fun. I'm actually learning things. And we've been speaking with Marianne Merton, the parliamentary correspondent for the Daily Maverick. And I wish we could have another hour. I have a long laundry list of other topics, but I don't think we're going to get to them this time. And maybe we'll have you back in another few months after the parliament finishes up. And we can do a scorecard on what's happened and where it's gone. This is Brooke Spector, and this has been yet another install another episode of The Deep Dive. As I say, Marion Merton, parliamentary correspondent, and she's helped us understand what that mysterious body does with all of its strange, unusual language inside that black box. She's opened the lid and we've seen all the gears inside. Again, tune in next week for another episode, another edition of The Deep Dive.